This is Speak Up. Speak Up airs every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday here on CJSF with our related program, Speak Up, Act Up. No, Speak Up. Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon, with host Cheryl, Charlotte Farrell on Fridays and Intervenus on Wednesdays. All those programs are every weekday at 10 a.m., so please tune in for the rest of this program and be back here tomorrow for another episode. Coming up in about half an hour is Democracy Now! Here on CJSF, so also stay tuned for that. Wandering Rhythms up at 12 noon and lots more great programming throughout the day. Danny Nesvadirani recently did an interview with about issues of extreme heat. We've had a number of heat domes and other heat events in Vancouver and and BC in general in the last few years, and they definitely seem to be something that is becoming more common and something we need to be both concerned about but also prepared for. Being prepared for the heat, having a plan on how to get out of the heat, making sure you're thinking about and looking after your family members and neighbors is going to be more and more important. Here is Danny's interview.
This is Bird Note. It's early May. We're standing in a large hayfield in western New York State, where bobolinks are returning to nest.
Reporting from Bernard.
The males are first to arrive.
I'm Dr. Anthony.
Look, it's been said.
I'm Dr. Anthony.
Tuxedos backwards. In about a week, the females, too, will complete a round-trip journey of more than 12,000 miles from the pampas of Brazil and Argentina. Why are there now so many fewer bobolinks than in decades past? Probably because the landscape of North America has changed so much. Bobolinks originally nested on native prairies of the Midwest and southern Canada. When much of this grassland came under intense cultivation, they expanded their range eastward to hayfields and meadows. Bobolinks like large, infrequently plowed fields that offer broad-leaved plants, under which the females build their nests directly on the ground. In the Northeast, there are fewer hayfields, and many have been converted to alfalfa, vegetation bobolinks don't normally use. Also, hayfields are now being mowed earlier than they used to be, and the mowing coincides with the peak of bobolink nesting. Support for federal and local efforts that conserve grassland habitat can help these far-flying birds. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Now here is Danny Nesvadirani's report on SFU's research on extreme heat events.
A recent research study out of Simon Fraser University in Burnaby has highlighted the gaps in the province's response to extreme heat events. Spearheaded by Andrianne Doyen, associate professor at SFU's School of Resource and Environmental Management, this is the first time that BC's extreme heat response among local governments has been analyzed in a formal research study. To gain more insight on what gaps, as well as potential solutions in BC's heat mitigation strategies that Doyen identified through this study, CJSF reached out to speak with her on the topic. During our interview, we spoke about what motivated Doyen to pursue this project, how different jurisdictions in BC can collaborate on heat mitigation, and the next steps of this research, which includes a look at the housing policy of one of the areas most affected by the extreme heat dome in the summer of 2021, Burnaby, BC.
I spent 6.5 years in Australia, and that's where I did my PhD, and then did my first academic position. And that's useful because in Australia, it gets pretty hot. So in the summer of 2021, when we were experiencing the heat dome event, I began getting a lot of requests from media asking me, can I talk about the relationship between cities and climate change? And I was like, of course I can. And, you know, obviously part of that was, well, how does heat play into it? And so, again, having this interest in cities and climate change, and then having lived somewhere where planning for heat is much more common, I was having these really great conversations and being called in. And I kept asking myself, like, you know, what else should I be doing? But also, like, what research is missing? What does it look like to ask questions within a region that has historically not experienced a lot of extreme heat events? So thinking about our you know, relatively temperate climate here, you know, in Vancouver, but in the Pacific Northwest as well. So I was really interested in, you know, after this, surviving the summer of 2021, I was like, I want to study heat here. I really want to know what's happening, and then how can we improve our preparedness and our response for future extreme heat events. So that's kind of the background where my interests and my experiences collided. And then I really wanted to see if there was something here. So I applied for a grant with the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, SHRT, and was successful in getting that money. So myself and my team of grad students began to start investigating questions around planning for extreme heat within the region.
And if you could just talk about what were some of those conclusions that you did come to, like from the research in terms of solutions regarding how BC and different jurisdictions can address extreme heat events?
Yeah, so we were really interested in understanding the role of planning. So really thinking about within that, the role or mechanisms of urban greenery, urban design, and then land use planning. So what we were seeing is that a lot of the response was public health and emergency management, which is really important, but those tend to be quite short-term in their thinking. There's a heat wave, you know, predicted next week. What are we doing about it? Whereas I'm really interested in in 10 years from now, will our neighborhoods and our houses and our cities be better prepared? So we wanted to look at that question. So what were they doing? And so when you think about what can cities or municipalities do, cities tend to be a lot hotter than naturalized environments or rural environments due to the urban heat island effect. And that is because our cities are made up of much harder surfaces. So harder surfaces and darker colors really absorb heat. We see less vegetation, which also sort of helps create more heat. And we see a lot less, you know, wind and other types of things that can move things through. So we see these really hot pockets exist in cities, but also within cities, depending on the type of development that is occurring in that density. So one mechanism, and the mechanism that is most popularly used, not only in the lower mainland here, like in Metro Vancouver and Fraser Valley, but kind of globally, is urban greenery. So it's increasing vegetation, tree cover, canopy, access to parks, and also access to what people call blue spaces. So like rivers, lakes, ponds, oceans, you know, if you live on the coast, it's cooler as well. So that's the most common response. And, you know, perhaps not surprising, it's an easy sell. Most people like trees, most people like parks. So wanting to either maintain or increase tree cover, canopy, and parks is usually something that politically is easier to sell. A lot of residents want that. Also, grants side of things, it's not the most expensive of interventions. Of course, creating a brand new park can be quite costly, but planting some trees compared to some other initiatives, you know, can be lower cost as well. So that's what we see, and we did see that here. Other interventions really focus on the more sort of standard, what we'd consider to be the built environment. So one of that is about looking at the relationship between how much hard surface estate we have and how much vegetation do we have? What types of materials are we using? We know that darker colors creates even more hotter environments. So you see places like Australia that really are pushing for people to have light colored roofs to, you know, have the exterior of their homes with lighter colors, because it, you know, it does help. The quality of construction of our homes makes a huge difference. So well-insulated homes help to keep your home cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter. So we know that during the heat dome, 98% of the people who lost their lives did so within residential units. So they did so within homes. So we know moving forward, much more attention needs to be provided there. Air conditioning is obviously sort of a solution that particularly the provincial government, BC Hydro, and the health authorities really responded with. And that's important, particularly within vulnerable populations, seniors, and people with existing health conditions. But it's not really a great solution long term.
The one part of the research study that I noticed what talked about how different jurisdictions can sort of better collaborate when it comes to addressing extreme heat within the province. What are some of the mechanisms or strategies around that?
Well, one of the things we found is that there were, in fact, some municipalities were doing really great work, right? So we see, you know, Vancouver, Surrey, New Westminster is having a lot of really great programs and initiatives. And so part of our kind of, and this might feel like a kind of a throwaway thing, but part of wanting municipalities to collaborate is some of your neighbors might already be doing good work. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just learn from someone who's already maybe a little bit further ahead. So really wanting, you know, municipalities to think about that. There's a lot of knowledge already in the region. Perhaps you can share and build off of that. So that's really important. The other thing is when we think about planning, at the municipal level, it's connected to the province because the province decides what is any municipality's responsibility, what powers they have, what they don't have. So there's a connection there, but there's also a connection in terms of the province will mandate or create programs to encourage municipalities to do things. And so if the province says heat is something that you need to respond to, the municipalities will respond to it. If the province isn't saying anything, then individual municipalities are really left to themselves to decide if it's something that they want to do anything about. So one of the things we looked at is every municipality in the province has complete these climate scorecards. And we were interested to see what were they putting on them. And so we did actually note that a number of them were starting to put heat as something that they were worried about. So again, but what we need is sort of top-down response from the province to kind of mainstream heat as a hazard that municipalities need to worry about, but also provide some information, some resources to help these municipalities out. Vancouver and Surrey are very well resourced. We were not surprised that they had more programs. They have huge teams, lots of capacity, and they're leaders in climate action in the province. What about the municipalities that don't have those teams, those capacity? How do they get started? So, you know, the province can play a really strong role there. And the province can also help create better relationships between the health authorities and the municipalities.
I know that your follow-up research seems to have a focus specifically within Burnaby. What have you seen so far that the municipality or city of Burnaby has done regarding heat mitigation, you know, knowing that during the 2020 heat dome, they were one of the municipalities that were most affected by the heat?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the reasons why we picked them. So they were the fourth, they had the fourth highest death rate during the 2021 heat dome. And we, again, wanted to focus on housing because of the impact that housing had on people's survival rates. Also, City of Burnaby, and this is something that not everyone might know, it actually is really progressive in its housing policy. So throughout the region, Burnaby's doing really great things in terms of the housing policy space. So we wanted to look at this question of housing in a city that was both impacted by the extreme heat event, but also was already doing things in housing. And we wanted to see, is there a relationship between housing and heat, but also equity, because that's a big part of understanding the impacts of this. We chose Burnaby for those reasons. It's also great because we work in Burnaby, right? At SFU, that's where we're located. So it was also an opportunity to connect and work with local folks. Also, we thought Burnaby provided a bit of a context that we could learn from and think about across the province. So Burnaby, in terms of our first study of looking at, well, who is planning for heat and how, they kind of were mid-pack. They weren't doing nothing, but they weren't the best. So we also thought, as sort of a mid-pack municipality in terms of their heat response, we could hopefully find things that would be relevant for other municipalities to learn as well. So what we have found so far is something that I kind of discussed a bit earlier in terms of what the role the province could take is, in the city of Burnaby, no one owns heat. And this is something that kept coming up again and again in interviews. It's no one's responsibility. And yet a lot of staff members are doing things to respond to heat and to prepare for extreme heat events. But there's no one person, role, or department that explicitly has heat in their portfolio. It is something that social planners are working on, land use planners, emergency management, the libraries, community services. There's lots of people involved, but no one is responsible for bringing this all together or for championing heat. And that's a problem, because when you need to make big decisions, when you need to bring things to council, when you want a champion, but you also want it to be, again, in someone's job description or department, because then it gets attention all year round.
The last thing that I would like to ask you is if you have any advice or recommendations for people who want to not only learn more about heat mitigation strategies, but how to advocate for them in their municipalities if they feel as if their local governments are coming short.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it is important to advocate at your local government level, because they are the level of government that is the closest to you. And when it comes to, again, urban greenery, urban design, land use, housing policy, a lot of that comes from your municipal governments. In different, municipalities that we looked at, in some of the municipalities that had really low, not a lot of programs or not a lot of explicit mentions of heat, we see that some of those cities are traditionally ones that have less climate action. So there is definitely a need to push that heat needs to be something that we think about. It needs to be something that we think about all year round. When this paper first came out a few weeks ago, I was worried, because I was like, oh no, it came out in spring, not summer. Is anyone going to care about planning for extreme heat? And people have been really receptive to it, which is really great. But that speaks to, we need to think about this all year round. We need to provide resources to it. For some, I think it's also about how you frame it. For some folks, we can think of extreme heat as a climate hazard, and we need to be thinking about our relationship to climate change in cities. For other municipalities or for other people, the way to approach this might be more on the health side, right? We want to prevent future deaths. We want to prevent future heat-related illnesses. During the heat dome, it's estimated that 5,000 to 6,000 people were impacted by heat-related illnesses in addition to the deaths, right? So it can be a heat issue. It's also a productivity issue, right? I don't know if you remember, but it wasn't wonderful working conditions during these heat events as well. We think about the people working indoors, but also the people working outdoors. It was unworkable conditions. So we really need to be thinking about our ability. So I would really encourage folks to think about, what is the thing that you think your council is going to be more receptive to? Is it job productivity? Is it health? Is it climate change? And really work heat into those things, because heat actually does impact all of those things.
Once again, that was Andrianne Doyen, Associate Professor at SFU School of Resource and Environmental Management, on her research study that analyzed BC's extreme heat responses among local governments. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
It's time for Gardening this with Embark. Joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas, Gardens Manager for Embark Sustainability.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
It's we're into week 18.
Correct, yes.
Getting a little deeper in the season.
That's right. And 8 more weeks, and we will start thinking about our nursery for the fall, week 26. So, yeah.
It's coming up.
Coming up very fast, yeah.
So, last week we talked about watering, and I was reflecting on that during the week, how it perhaps applies to my houseplants.
All right.
Because, I have a number of houseplants, and they did really well for a number of years. And then in the last year, they did quite poorly. And I was thinking about our conversation about, you know, watering and watering completely and making sure the whole garden was full of water. And I was thinking, you know, I used to take my houseplants and I'd take them to the sink and fill up the pots and let them drain out the bottom.
Right.
So that they were nicely saturated. And I thought, you know, over the last year or so, I got lazy and I just poured a little water in the top every time it told me to do so.
Yes.
And I was thinking about how you're telling me how the roots, mm-hmm. you know, if the water's not there, the roots don't go.
Yes, that's right. Yes. The water is just in the surface. Yeah.
And I could imagine this little cone of water in my pot that was wet and not enough to keep the plant really healthy. So I'm gonna go back to doing it, making sure those pots are fully filled.
That's right.
And it's, you know, I mean, and it's interesting just because it looked, you know, they always looked like they're doing what, you know, the top of the soil was, but, you know, when you're just pouring a bit in the top and stuff, you can't really know
How deep they went, the water yeah. went through. Yeah. So one of the things that as well we tend to think is that the water will spread horizontally.
Yeah.
Which is not the case. Water follows gravity, goes yeah. vertically.
Right.
So if you just put in one place, it won't expand mm-hmm. horizontally. So right. that's another thing that we have to consider.
Yeah. Awesome. We've got some other things to talk about today, though.
Oh,
you're moving in the garden.
Correct. So Embark Sustainability is moving our garden that has been for around 8-9 years behind task one.
Yeah.
And we are moving that garden to the field behind Maggie Benstone Center.
Right.
So we
are to a much more central place on campus.
Correct. Close to the student union, yeah. close to the AQ and the convocation mall. So mm-hmm. more visible. So we are moving our garden slowly over this year and the next. And at the moment, we are in the process of setting up 10 garden plots and bringing our vertical gardens that were in Surrey. And, topping up all those garden beds
yeah.
and slowly start growing vegetables.
Yeah.
As well, we got some picnic tables. So we are creating a community space for everyone around to come and enjoy the garden, the
nice.
Views, the vegetables. And the weather today is, and this week is going to be so nice, the weather. So, yeah, we are very glad that the garden is taking shape and becoming a community center.
Great. And with week 18, you're also transitioning some of the plants that you've got in the garden.
Yes, at the moment we're just moving what is the Swiss chard that we had in the other garden. We have some spinach. We tried to put some tomatoes. We're thinking to put tomatoes, but it's still too cold.
Right.
So we are holding the tomatoes still under cover before moving over. So the new area is very open. So mm-hmm. there is wind coming very much from the Burnaby Mountain,
yeah.
South Slope, and so it's very windy. So we still are trying to understand how this gardening will work. So this year number one, when you are doing gardening, is always trying to understand how the garden, the climate in the garden, how the sun travels, where there is the predominant wind coming, when it rains, where the rain accumulates.
Right.
And so we, at the moment, are just starting to learn how this garden will work and, yeah, which are the hot spots. So at the moment, our garden plots are just in the perfect site, lots of sunlight, so yeah. We expect to have a good area for summer crops.
And this is something any gardener needs to think about, you know, whether they're starting a new garden or perhaps they've moved to a new home and they're, you know,
correct.
They're gardening somewhere different. They really got to figure out their immediate local environment.
That's right. Yes. Where is the warm and dry space and where is the shade and cold space and perhaps more moisture in there? So that keeps us on the rules how we manage our plants. Yeah.
Great. One of the things that Embark does, and one of the things you really do, is mm-hmm. run gardening programs that allow people to participate and learn about gardening. And you have some programs underway already and
yes.
more coming up. So tell me about that.
All right. So, yeah, Embark, because we have two gardens here in campus, we run what we call the gardening cohort.
Yeah.
We have capacity up to 16 people to come and join us. So what happens is during these weeks that we meet once a week for 1.5 hours. I share all the experiences on what you have to consider when you start gardening. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any knowledge about, so developing your gardening skills. So each week we have a theme that we talk about, we explore. Besides that, each participant get a small garden plot, a 4x4 raised garden bed, and we provide seedlings, seeds, tools, fertilizer, compost, for them to really get hands-on and start planting. And by doing, by holding seeds, by placing the seeds in the spot, in the garden, following a gardening pattern, and as well, you start developing your skills. And when the seeds germinate, everybody is happy because, oh, what I put in is dry, is growing. So it's all the instant reward that you will see. And then we move into gardening care. And as well, we explore, as we have been talking here, about how to do when there is pests, how to water, how to maintain the garden, and as well, realize how the sun travel, where my plants goes in the garden bed, tall plants, short plants. We talk about companion planting, intercropping, and succession, plant succession as well. So all that. And as well, if there is time, we explore about all the gardening methods and philosophies that we as well have been touching in here. So there is a broad view about what gardening implies, and perhaps this creates an interest in the participant that say, oh yeah, organic is just is a part of a large component. So which my interests will tend to. So some people decide I'm going fully biodynamics and gardening by the moon, applying certain nutrients and so on. Other could say, oh, square foot gardening is my approach. I will take with that. The others perhaps say, oh, no, traditional raw gardening is my way, but I'm attaching these other components. So, so that is what the gardening cohort attempts, is to bring all basic knowledge and develop gardening skills for the those who don't have any gardening knowledge. But for those who have the gardening knowledge, the challenge come like, okay, now we have decide which method we are going to use. Let's go a bit more deeper in companion planting, intercropping, plant succession.
Well, it sounds like, one of the things, I think we've learned through these conversations, is, there's so many different factors in your success when you're gardening. And, for a starting out gardener, or even someone who's got a bit of experience, I'm sure many people encounter lots of problems and where, they don't necessarily realize what they're doing wrong. And, working in a cohort like this with other folks, and as well as someone like yourself, you're going to learn those things faster. If you're not watering properly, or you're, being too rough with the plants, or whatever it might be.
Correct.
Yes. And you may not realize those things are affecting, your output at the end of the growing season.
Yep. Yes.
But, in a group like this where you're all growing together and you're seeing what other people are doing and stuff, you're really going to learn a lot of that stuff.
Yes, that happens. And as well, a community is created. Although we are just 6 weeks together, a small community creates. There's people that have same interest, and they've been talking about how my plant is doing and why your plant is not doing well. Right. And both planted the same broccoli at the same time. It's like, what happened? And so, that you are right. So, by joining this group, you develop your skills and knowledge faster because you are exchanging knowledge and interests with other people too. Yep. So that is at the moment we are finishing our spring gardening cohort, and next week we'll start with our summer gardening cohort again for 6 weeks. So we run from May the 13th until the June the 15th, more or less. June is very short. We take as well a break because...
And unfortunately, we're running out of time to get to right to the end of Gardening with Embark this week. You can find out more about the Gardens program and joining one of the garden cohorts at the Embark website, embarksustainability.org. Democracy Now! Is coming up right after this show, right now.